Oh my God, breaking news, CNN. One Israeli hurt in a rocket attack. When will the Palestinian occupation of Israel ever end? Nah, I'm just kidding. Anyway, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Stop by the chat room, why don't you? Join up the chat room. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Got a great group of people in there, as always. And, well, okay, it's a small group, but it's a great group. Great, not in the large sense, but in, you know, just quality. But anyway, the rest of you guys could join up if you want to. Just go to scotthorton.org/chat, put in a fake name and a caption, you're in. It's an IRC chat, a free node chat, but you don't need any external applications to get in there. You can just go to scotthorton.org/chat, sign on in. Anyway, so that's the thing. Today on the show, Nancy Youssef and Con Hallinan. I keep screwing up the time zone problems here. Well, I screwed up Con yesterday. I think Nancy screwed up her time zone. I screwed up Con's, and then I double booked them both for the same time today to correct it. So that's not good. But anyway, so I guess I'm not positive which order they'll be on the show today. But the plan is to talk with Nancy Youssef and to Con Hallinan on the show. Con wrote this in-depth piece about the different oceanic controversies in East Asia. And Nancy Youssef's been writing about the crisis in Libya. Also, Marcy Wheeler's going to be on to talk about the torture report, what little more we are learning about it. It's not out yet. But there's some controversy there. The Senate, let's see, so there's a torture report and then torture and the Senate. Spying thing. Yeah. Oh, and then there was new NSA stuff to talk with her about, too. I think. What was the NSA question I was going to ask her? Let me see. I better check my sent email. I should really take better notes in the morning. New NSA Senate thing and torture talking points. What's the new NSA Senate thing? Oh, that's right. The Leahy bill. New Senate. I better write that down since apparently I keep forgetting. Yeah. All right. So Marcy Wheeler going to talk with her about that. And then I got a couple more invites out. God dang it. That Doug Bandow is just always too dang busy to do my show. But I'm a big Bandow fan. I was trying to get him on to talk about why to stay out of Iraq. Mitchell Prothero, I tried to get him on about Iraq, but he's busy writing about it. So, okay. I guess that's acceptable, since that's really his job and everything. Maybe we'll get him on the show tomorrow. Yeah, all right. So, obviously, in the news, Iraq, Ukraine, and Israel's war on Gaza. And so let me go ahead and get started on the Gaza news here. Let me put this lower down the list here. First of all, this is basically just the headlines from antiwar.com for you today. And thanks to the guys who do the top of the hour news. Do I have the best top of the hour news in the business going on here on the Liberty Radio Network? The FPP Radio News and the other one too, I forget off the top of my head. Man, that's great. Best top of the hour news in the history of talk radio. Am I right? Yes, I am right. I said out loud, didn't I? All right. Israeli cabinet vows to intensify Gaza war, over 1,400 killed. You know, the fact that I saw Israel, I was going to say Israeli TV, CNN this morning said 1,300 plus Gazans killed, 59 Israelis. I got an exact count of Israelis because it's still less than 60, thank you. But we got to start rounding because we don't know how many bodies are still buried under the rubble when you start trying to count the dead in Gaza. Numbers all of a sudden get fuzzy. you know, like Democrat math. Because nobody really knows yet, but it's more than 1,400 killed. Thank you, CNN. It's more than 1,400 killed. UN slams growing attacks on civilian targets. That's Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Israel calls up 16,000 more reservists. 86,000 since start of the war. Military call-ups, response to cabinet's order to escalate in Gaza. And now Jeremy Sapienza pointed out on Twitter yesterday that the fighting age males of Israel are in the IDF, not in any ridiculous, you know, collective guilt sense that, oh, they're fighting age males so we can kill them, that the Israelis claim about really everyone in Gaza, whether they're fighting age males or not. But no, literally, they are all in the IDF. It's true, they're conscripts, but then again, the opinion polls show super-duper majority support for the policy over there, so. And they are actually members of the IDF, so I'm not saying it's morally justified for Hamas to shoot at them, but I am saying that under the laws of war, somewhere right around there anyway, I guess not when they're out of uniform. Well, I don't know. They're on a base or not? I don't know what the laws of war are when it comes to whether they're on or off base. But the fighting age population, male and female, of Israel are in the IDF. Wait, sorry. I thought I knew that, but now I'm second-guessing myself about the females. I know there are a lot of females in the IDF, but are they conscripted the way the males are? Chat room guys, do you know? Sorry. I may have screwed that up. All right. Well, anyway, still an important point, though, when the spin out of Israel is that, hey, the people of Gaza are collectively guilty for voting for Hamas, even though that was way back in 2006. That was 8 years ago. And most of the people in Gaza to this day are, you know, 50-50, half of them, are minors now. So even more of them were minors back then. So they could not possibly have voted for Hamas. And then nobody knows exactly who voted for Hamas and who didn't in the election in 2006 anyway. Do we? So how could they be collectively guilty for that? I hated Bill Clinton, still do, more than anyone in all of North America. Does that make me responsible for all the innocent people that he killed in the 1990s? No. That makes me not responsible. I was an opponent of all that killing back then. Just because I'm from here. But I didn't voluntarily join up Bill Clinton's army. If I had, I would have been, you know, a target. Maybe still, maybe not quite an innocent one anymore, you know? Anyway, sorry. Israel pounds crowded Gaza marketplace, kills 17. You just heard coverage of this on the top of the hour news there. Israel announced a humanitarian lull and then ignored it. They said, here, you got 4 hours to go collect your dead and go try to, you know, buy some potassium for your children to eat at the marketplace, and then, blam, bomb the hell out of them. And the footage is there. You can find it on Twitter. I think I retweeted it. Someone sent it to me this morning. No human shields. That's what he said, the tweeterer. No human shields, just humans. Watch as Israel shells a marketplace full of women and children. Kills them. Only 17? Wounding 160 others. Israeli general insists strike on Gaza power plant an accident. Yeah, well, if you go look at the anti-war blog right now, you'll find an article by Dan Sanchez pointing out how important it is for Israel's media war to shut off the power, to shut off those cell phones and those cell phones' access to Twitter. They're losing the media war, and how to win it is to bomb the power plant. You think that's an accident? Tell me you believe the Israelis that's an accident. you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm sitting here paging through my Twitter, and here's the caption. Man volunteered to baby this... Yeah, nice radio, Scott. Man volunteered to bury this baby girl because all her family were killed in Gaza. That's just some guy holding the corpse of a, oh, I don't know, 8-month-old or so. So, well, I'll do it. Somebody's got to bury her, right? Yep. That money, every Friday when you get your check and you look at the gross and the net and you go, oh, my God, look how much money they took out of my check. That's where your money went, to pay for Israel to kill babies. And everybody else in their family, too, you know. So the strangers got to bury their, what's left of their corpses. Yeah. Anyway. I wonder what that is. I have to look at that. I don't understand it. Sorry, I got an email about a technical issue, and it didn't make any sense to me. I should have just waited to try to read it later on. All right. Israel defends attacking another UN school full of refugees in Gaza. Now, Jason counts very carefully, and he does not embellish, and he says there are 3 so far UN schools with refugees inside that have been bombed by the Israeli forces so far. Now, Jake Tapper, in a story last night at CNN, said they have bombed 6 UN schools so far. And I asked Jason about that, and he said, well, maybe he's referring to total, and I'm referring to only the ones that actually had civilians in them at the time. So it's only 3 schools full of refugees who actually were refugees before they were in the schools, because that's how they got to Gaza anyway, but never mind that. The refugees who fled and became refugees squared, hiding inside the UN school, 3 of those have been bombed now by the Israelis. And again, back to the anti-war blog and this article by Dan Sanchez about Back to Black. That's right, you turn off the electricity, and you know, have you seen, I can't vouch for the authenticity of this, although if it's a scam, a lot of people been buying it, that's all I know. The market test has seemed to have shown that it's true, that there's this little girl tweeting from Gaza, 16-year-old girl supposedly, who people are like comparing her to Anne Frank and all this stuff. Well, my cell phone's dying, guys. No way to charge it, so this will be my last tweet. Please don't worry about me. Thanks for saying hi. And all this, like, just completely pitiful stuff. Well, this is the story all across the Gaza Strip, and apparently it is confirmed. At least, I read it in quite a few places. I searched it in Google News yesterday after the show. Actually, into last night, I kept searching. I didn't find anyone contradicting this, and I've seen a doctor who is verified to be a doctor in Gaza on Twitter putting this out himself. It's a story I mentioned yesterday about the little girl who her mother, and I didn't realize this, her mother had been dead for 10 minutes before she was delivered, which is, that's why they called it the miracle baby, because usually 5 minutes, absolute tops for a dead mother, you know, being able to still deliver a live birth, or, well, that's a, for the doctors to be able to save a live baby from a dead mother. But then the baby did die, and it was because the Israelis turned out the lights and turned off the incubators that the baby died. That was what did it. You know, remember when a hoax about an incubator was enough to get you into a war? on the side of Kuwait, the monarchy of Kuwait, against the Republican sock puppet dictator Saddam Hussein. Huh. How confusing is that? All it took was the slightest bit of crap, and America went right to war, started a lot of this mess.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
Yeah, so. There you go. Well, that's what the Israelis did, in effect. The miracle baby, they murdered it. The miracle baby whose mother they murdered and survived anyway. They murdered it too. Oh no, they accidentally. You know what, guys? We are gonna have an investigation and get to the bottom of how we accidentally bombed the power station. Shut up. You're a liar and a baby murderer. Give me a break. You're gonna distract me with that nonsense. Oh, on one hand, oh, we should win the Nobel Prize for the humanitarian lengths we go through to protect civilian life with our laser-guided, satellite-assisted, pinpoint-targeted strikes. We do more than anyone has ever done ever to not kill people with all of our wonderful bombing raids killing people. But you know what? Somehow we keep accidentally bombing schools full of refugees and power stations and water treatment and sewage plants. Accidentally. Yeah, really, huh? Maybe that's why Andrea Mitchell, who is as mainstream, as centrist, as establishment consensus Zionist as you could get on American television, has asked whether Israel is maybe, she asked the Israeli ambassador, whether Israel might be losing its soul in these attacks on Gaza. She's concerned, man. And now listen to this. This morning, Joe Scarborough, the Republican politician, again, you know, would be conservative, but not really. He's just a kind of center-right, a pretty establishmentarian Republican congressman, former congressman, of course, Morning Joe on MSNBC. This morning he said this is asinine, this continued killing of women and children in a way that appears to be indiscriminate is asinine. And then he goes on to defend himself. I'm as pro-Israel as any congressman ever. The joke was I could have got a gold-plated key to Tel Aviv, to the city of Tel Aviv, if I'd asked. But he says, and get this, again, this is Joe Scarborough, former Republican congressman, still a self-identified conservative Republican. The United States of America, we cannot be associated with this if this continues. This is so bad. And I love the way he phrases this, too. Not only for the Israeli people, but for us. All right, still never mind the Palestinians. They're still only the prop and how bad can we hurt ourselves here, according to his take on it. But he's saying, this is bad for Israel. This makes the whole world think of Israel as just, what are you, a nation of child killers? What is this murder spree? What is this canned hunt without limit? How can you keep doing this over and over again? How can you keep bombing refugees and schools and playgrounds and power plants and water stations? This is bad for you. And then he fears, this is bad for us. Well, I got news for you, Joe Scarborough. The official story is that Palestinian blowback first hit America in 1968. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And first up on the show today is Nancy Youssef from McClatchy Newspapers. normally based out of Cairo, but now back in the States, at least for a little while, I guess. Welcome back to the show, Nancy. How are you?
Great. It's great to be with you.
Very happy to have you here. Appreciate it. And appreciate your coverage of the Libya story. Something that I'm actually kind of glad it doesn't get that much attention, because I fear what might be done if it did get a lot of attention. But it certainly is a lot of bad news out of there, and we need to know it. So I appreciate the great work that you're doing. The last piece, at least that I found from you on it, was U.S. evacuates Libyan embassy amid growing unrest. And people want to get around the McClatchy paywall. You can find this at MiamiHerald.com as well. U.S. evacuates Libyan embassy amid growing unrest. So I guess, if you'll forgive me for asking such a general question, could you just describe the growing unrest for us, please?
Sure. What's happened in the western part of Libya was something that was really up until a few months ago exclusive to the east, which was fighting between secular and Islamist militia groups. And so for the past few weeks, we've seen really fierce fighting around Tripoli's main airport. Nearly every plane there destroyed. We're talking about billions of dollars worth of damage between these rival militia groups for control of the airport. And the fighting has only escalated with every passing week, scores dead every week. And so for the U.S. and for its embassy staff there, the shutdown of the airport really made it all the more precarious in terms of needing to evacuate embassy personnel. It made it that much harder, given that the airport was essentially a non-option. And so in light of this fighting, which some would describe as a civil war, there was an assessment made to evacuate the embassy, destroy any classified documents or take out any classified information, and move all personnel out to neighboring Tunisia. The U.S. ambassador to Libya, Deborah Jones, is now operating from nearby Malta.
Wow. Yeah, so it was really the airport was the final straw for him, huh? But then, so, when you say some call it a civil war, it sounds like maybe the question there, a civil war's got to be more organized than this. There's so many people on the different battlefields that nobody can even tell how much power any given faction is fighting for at any given moment, doesn't seem like.
Well, the complicating fact and facts in Libya is that it's not just Islamists versus secularists. It's communities versus communities, cities versus cities. Remember, each city, major city or big city in Libya has a militia. This was born out of the 2011 uprising, and each one now feels it has certain rights to the future of the country or certain claims to the future government and whatnot. So it's Islamist versus Islamist, it's East versus West, it's city versus city. And so while it's not as linear as a civil war, I do think that there are organized factions within it that are fighting one another. It's just, in a sense, a multi-front war, and various interest groups battling one another throughout the country right now.
Well, so I know the BBC has said there are as many as 1,700 different militias. I guess obviously some of them would be more major tribal militias and others smaller factions, that kind of thing. Can you give us any kind of estimate about that?
I can. I mean, I think that's as good. You know, it depends on how you define a militia versus one versus another. Is it three men? Is it four men? You know, we're talking about people who are claiming them. There's no sort of agreed upon definition, right, in terms of what constitutes a militia. Mm-hmm. And because there's no real national force, we're talking about neighborhoods creating their own militias, streets creating their own militias. So it gets down to such a micro level. The ones that are sort of most important, though, are the ones that control big cities like Zaytan and Misrata, where we from in the West, where we've seen them battle it out for control of the airport. So that's not out of the realm of possibility, 1,700, but the ones that matter are the ones that were really instrumental in the 2011 uprising.
Mm-hmm. And then, so that's, is that Ansar al-Sharia? How powerful are they compared to some of the others?
Well, they're very powerful, and in fact, today they declared that they had taken formally control of Benghazi, the biggest city in the east, the second biggest city in Libya, a city that this country has come to know because of the 2012 attack that killed the U.S. ambassador at the time, Chris Stevens, along with three other Americans. And so just today, Ansar al-Sharia declared itself in control of the city. Beyond the militia, they're really one of the most powerful factions in Libya, and not only provide security forces, but social services, control hospitals, control healthcare, control services like trash pickup. So they're much bigger than sort of when we think of militias as sort of a group that, that provides security. Their breadth of control is much wider than almost any other faction in Libya. And the fact that they've declared control today of Benghazi is a big development because it marks a real big loss for Khalifa Haftar, who was the secular commander who had started this Operation Dignity a couple months ago, trying to wrest control of the east away from the Islamists. And it appears, based on today's announcement, that he has resoundingly lost that battle, and the Islamists have regained control of the east.
Mm. And so what can you tell us about Haftar? Well, I guess let me be more specific. Is it your impression that this guy is working for the CIA, that this is their attempted move to marginalize the Islamists and take back over this revolution here, or is he just, you know, off on his own here, or what?
That's a great question. I mean, certainly amongst the Libyans, the presumption is that he's a CIA operative. He lived in Northern Virginia, had a number of speeding violations while he was here, and was believed to be a CIA operative at the time. The thing that gives me some pause about whether he's currently working for the CIA is that the United States doesn't seem to have any real control over him, and he seems to be a bit of a loose cannon, that for somebody who, if he were sort of a proper CIA operative, one would think would have more control and have a more organized movement than he's had. But that label, that patina of being a CIA operative, I think has hurt his efforts to rally support around him and his efforts to contain the Islamist threat in Libya, even as so many Libyans oppose what groups like Ansar Sharia are doing. I think at the same time they don't trust Khalifa Haftar and his motives and those who back him.
Mm-hmm. And so now, I guess, as far as the different factions in Tripoli, could you compare his power relative to Ansar al-Sharia's power in Benghazi? Are they sort of equal but separate at this point, or is their power much more than his, you think?
Is Ansar Sharia stronger than Haftar?
Yeah.
Given today's developments, I think it's fair to say that they are, because they were battling Haftar's forces quite aggressively for the past 2 months for control of Benghazi, and they have declared themselves the unabashed winners of the east. And
I'm sorry. I guess I didn't really realize he was the major force they were resisting there. But what about Haftar's power back in Tripoli?
Well, so one of the reasons we're seeing the battles at the airport are groups that were galvanized by Haftar, the sort of secular forces, and these Islamist forces who had retained control. So when Haftar started this operation about 2 months ago, there was a feeling that he had emboldened some of these secular groups to go back and try to take back control of the airport from the Islamists. So that's sort of been his impact, if you will, on the West primarily. A lot of the fighting that we're seeing there was sort of instigated by his push in the East to try to take back the country from the Islamists.
Mm-hmm. But then, so the airport now is still under the control of the Islamists, not his group, though, right?
That's right. I mean, it's been a really, really fierce battle.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. Let's hold it and go out to this break.
Okay.
When we get back, we'll talk more with Nancy Yosef from, I'm sorry, it's Yusuf, not Yosef, right?
That's right.
Right. Nancy Yosef from McClatchy Newspapers, and you also find her at MiamiHerald.com. U.S. evacuates Libyan embassy amid growing unrest. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State: The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, on the Liberty Radio Network. I'm talking with Nancy Youssef from McClatchy Newspapers. Usually she reports out of Cairo, but is back in the States here. And this article is called U.S. Evacuates Libyan Embassy Amid Growing Unrest. And boy, talk about unrest. Now, one sign of actual stability, possibly, I think, Nancy, was that they did have some kind of parliamentary election just in the last few weeks. Did that just make matters worse, or was there much participation in that election?
I don't know if it made matters worse, but one of the things to remember is that, you know, Libya is a relatively young state. The sort of the modern version that we know is from 1951. Of course, 42 years of that was under Gaddafi. And so the state sort of systems are quite weak. And what we've discovered is essentially there's really no functioning national government in Libya. And so while there were parliamentary elections, some would argue that it made things worse because the Islamists did so badly and they were therefore emboldened to perhaps turn to violence as a means to get their voice out. But either way, the state itself has been really quite weak since Gaddafi's fall. I mean, oftentimes I will talk to someone in Tripoli and ask them about something happening in Benghazi, and they have no idea what's going on because it's in another part of the country. I mean, that's just and we're talking about ministers, and these aren't just low-level government ministers, commanders, people who presumably would know basic things that are happening in other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. All right, now I know that, you know, Libya was actually only even created after World War II, and that it was originally three states with sort of a, you know, the east, the west, and the south there, and I won't try to pronounce the different states because I'll get it all wrong, but my question is it kind of an ethnic thing, like it's more Berbers in the west and Arabs in the east, something like that, or is it just tribal last name kind of differences, or what?
It's a little bit of both, but what's emerged is it's also very cultural. I mean, you really get the sense that you're in a different country when you're in eastern Libya than you are in western. And it was only exacerbated by Gaddafi himself because he put more resources into the west where the capital is and where he lived primarily. There was a sense of distrust of the east and the south, and so they didn't get the kinds of resources that they once would have presumably gotten if it were operating as one country. And so the sort of natural divisions were there, and they were only exaggerated by Gaddafi's rule. So it's the combination of the two that has complicated this effort to think of a unified Libyan state.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, your former colleague, David Enders, back in 2011 and in 2012, reported from McClatchy about anti-black pogroms, and I guess especially blacks from Misrata, sub-Saharan Africans, that is, were, you know, rounded up, many of them killed, and David reported from a refugee camp where there were mass rapes going on nightly back then, that kind of thing, and yet we hear so little about, well, whatever happened to the blacks of Western Libya anyway? Are they alive?
It's a great question. I mean, it's a community that's been ostracized in Libya throughout its history, but particularly since the fall of the regime. And that doesn't mean that Gaddafi was some kind of defender, but that there was law and order, or at least the fear of the state that sort of kept things in check. And that's all but dissipated in Libya now. And so the persecution of black Africans in Libya continues, but a lot have left the country altogether or are being detained. And so it's very hard to get any real assessment because the country is in such an unstable state that even getting to places that we as journalists could get to 6 months ago is simply a non-option now. Even Benghazi itself has become a no-go zone for many journalists because of the Islamist control of it. So it's so hard to get an assessment of what's happening to black Africans, because as it is, they were ostracized in Libya, and now we're trying to operate under a very dangerous security situation.
Yeah, it was one of those terrible witch hunt kind of things. I remember, too, they talked about how, well, Gaddafi didn't really have much of a military, mostly just his private Gestapo, and a lot of times he would hire mercenaries, and oftentimes from sub-Saharan Africa, but then that got completely turned around and conflated where all black Africans are at least suspected of being hired mercenaries for Gaddafi, even though most of them are just day laborers and maybe even lower on the economic ladder than that. They're nobodies, but rounded up as though they're, you know, the oppressors and the overlords under Gaddafi.
That's exactly right. I mean, and the thing is, there, one of the things, Libya is a relatively small state in terms of population. We're talking somewhere between 4 to 6 million. And so many workers left during the 2000 uprising. There were Filipinos, there were Egyptians, and you would go to the border and see hundreds, if not thousands, of people trying to get out of the country. But the sub-Saharan Africans who were there had the hardest time getting out of the country because they were essentially chased by Libyans almost immediately after the uprising began because of that association that you mentioned, that they were seen as fighters on behalf of Gaddafi in the war in Chad and other conflicts that Gaddafi had started to serve his own interests rather than the national one, wars that essentially, from the mainstream Libyan perspective, harm the state.
All right, now, is it okay if I ask you about American intervention over there? And
sure.
I guess it is okay, but you can say you don't know whenever you don't know. But Seymour Hersh seemed to report that, if I remember it right, that really after the Benghazi attack of September 11th, 2012, when Ambassador Stevens was killed, that the covert support for the Mujahideen and funneling guns and fighters to Syria, that operation basically stopped then. And I know Eli Lake, although, he reported a thing for the Daily Beast about, a couple of months ago that said that there was a training base where special forces were training up, so-called Libyan army troops. But then it got raided and robbed in the middle of the night one night, and they went ahead and pulled out from there. And that was over closer to Tripoli, I believe. But anyway, I was just wondering, that's what I think I know about it. Can you kind of fill in, what you know about the extent of American involvement there in terms of CIA special forces either going on missions or training up the military, working with the government over there, any of that kind of thing?
Well, there was talk about sending Libyans, I believe it was to Romania, but don't hold me to that, to do training missions, but it always gets thwarted. And now the U.S. is in this difficult position of who is it that you support? It's certainly, from the U.S. perspective, not Islamists. And Haftar and his forces have proven to be ineffectual and, frankly, unpredictable. And so the challenge is, who do you train, who do you trust to train, and who would lead them? There's such an absence of sort of a reliable partner from the U.S. perspective that it's only become increasingly harder to carry out those efforts to train and create a national Libyan force. And incidentally, even if that were possible, there is no real Libyan government to guide them. So it only leaves the country susceptible to these disparate forces that are armed and those arms getting into the wrong hands.
So, but anyway, you're saying, though, that the U.S. government also possesses that same wisdom you just said, and so therefore they're really reluctant to intervene any more than they already have?
Well, that's my.
That just sounds amazing.
Yeah, how does one intervene? To what end? Who does one support? And does
it? Right, but that never stopped them before, Nancy. That's all I'm saying.
Well, and the thing is, I was there in 2011 before the U.S. intervention and after it. And the thing is, one got the sense that it was really under pressure from Britain and France in particular to intervene. Their fear of cut off oil production, their fear of Libyan refugees coming through their borders, that it was done as much for the Allies as it was for this idea of democracy promotion in the region. And now, there's disagreement about how to proceed. What's interesting is we're not hearing any effort by France or the NATO allies who were so eager to intervene in 2011 to do so again now. That they're much more reticent. And so that is to say, in hindsight, I think one could argue that U.S. intervention the first time was quite reticent, and now it's even more so given where things have gone in just 3 years.
Yeah, well, that's the best news I've heard all week. Really, it seems I'm amazed daily when I hear very mainstream, very official, very establishment D.C. and New York voices sounding just like me on these same questions about intervening further in Iraq, too. That no, really, these lessons have been learned. There's just no way around it. We just can't do it. Where it seemed, I would have guessed that they would be, they'll stand up, we'll stand down and all that, George Bush 2005 in Iraq type rhetoric at this point and mission at this point in the Libya crisis. I mean, it was that obvious before the war that, the whole state will be destroyed by this and will have to be replaced somehow. And the fact that they haven't gone full scale toward that kind of nation building, I think, is incredible. And I'm so grateful for it. It could only make matters that much worse. But
Yeah, how do you intervene when their embassy's not
really,
there?
You know, that really is the policy now, is to just back off, sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so thank you so much for your time. It's great to talk to you again, Nancy.
Great to talk to you.
Appreciate it. That's Nancy Youssef from McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. And if you get stuck behind the paywall, go check her out at MiamiHerald.com. They reprint all of it there, too. It's U.S. evacuates Libyan embassy amid growing unrest. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. Next up is Con Hallinan from Foreign Policy in Focus, the Institute for Policy Studies there. Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. And boy, it sure seems from this article like while everybody's distracted with the major crises going on in the country formerly known as Iraq, in Gaza, in eastern Ukraine, there is a major crisis or perhaps a giant pile of crises arranging themselves to explode in East Asia. Parsing the East Asian Powder Keg is Khan's latest article here at Foreign Policy in Focus. How much worse can it get, Con? Welcome back to the show.
I don't know. You know, Tom Lehrer had that old line that you begin to feel like a Christian scientist with an appendicitis. This is sort of the way we're feeling right now. I mean, I think you ran through it. You know, the Middle East, the Ukraine, the you know, East Asia. You know, there's stuff going on in Latin America.
Well,
it's really
I think that's the most
on.
Frustrating about it to me is it doesn't have to be this way at all. Almost all of this stuff is the American Empire's fault. Poking around in hornets' nests where it doesn't belong, et cetera. It's not just we live in a dangerous world and isn't that frustrating. It's a bunch of no-good-nicks making it this way for stupid reasons.
Well, I agree. And you know, particularly if you take a look at the Middle East, there's a really interesting book I think that people should take the time to pick up and read. And it's Scott Anderson's new book called Lawrence in Arabia. And basically what it's about, it's less a biography of T.E. Lawrence, then it is a discussion of how the outcome of the First World War and basically the imperial agreements between the British and the French and then the Balfour Declaration basically set what the Middle East is today, and that if you look at the current upheaval, it's certainly the United States plays a major role in this, but it goes back basically to the imperial division, what they call the Great Loot, of the dismantling of the Ottoman Empire and the creation of colonies and spheres of influence by the British, the French, and the Americans, and you know that's what's playing out at this point. The Ukraine, you know, it's what's playing out is the residue of the Cold War and the march of NATO to the east. And that's also true in East Asia, which I think most people are sort of unaware of. I mean, they see this tension between Japan and China, and they say, well, you know, it certainly has something to do with World War II, because both sides are sort of talking about World War II. Chinese are very upset that the Japanese are not very apologetic for what they did in World War II, and the Japanese claim the Chinese are becoming more aggressive. And again, I think what most people don't realize is that a lot of that tension was built in very deliberately by the 1951 Treaty of San Francisco, which essentially ended or resolved the situation in Asia and dismantled the Japanese Empire. And what happened during those treaty discussions was that the United States very deliberately built in sort of two things it calls a strategic ambiguity and manageable instability. And what they did was they deliberately didn't resolve certain questions so that there would be this constant state of tension, and that would allow the United States to keep its military forces there and to inject itself in between these areas of tension. And,
well, now, wait a minute. Let me interrupt just to ask you to reemphasize that a little bit, because you didn't say it in a way where it sounds as huge as it really is, what you just said, that they're not over there making sure to guarantee stability. This is what prevents conflict. They're making sure that there's instability in order that they may have an excuse to be there.
Right. This is a very interesting study by a researcher, Kimi Hara, who's the director of East Asian Studies at Renison University College, which is part of the University of Waterloo near Toronto. What she found was that that the areas of tension, like, for instance, in the who owns these islands, the Diaoyu or the Senkaku Islands in the East China Seas, or the Doko or the Takashima Islands off of Korea, and a lot of areas dispute in the South China Sea. And what she found was that she found a lot of communications and part of the negotiations where the United States very deliberately built these kind of strategic ambiguity in so that there was no decisions made and the tensions would increase. And more than that, that the United States actively sabotaged efforts to create a peaceful circumstances. For instance, in 1954, Japan and the Soviet Union restored diplomatic relations, and they were sort of on the verge of cutting a deal over the Kurils, what the Japanese call the Kurile Islands, which are a string of islands north of Hokkaido, and what the Russians call the Northern Territories. So there are four major islands involved, and there are a lot of little islands, but there are four major islands involved in this chain. So the Russians and the Soviets and the Japanese were on the verge of cutting a deal, and they were going to basically split the difference. The Soviets said, okay, you take the two southern islands, we'll keep the two northern islands. And the U.S. stepped into that and torpedoed those negotiations, and they did so by telling the Japanese that if they cut a deal with the Soviets to split the difference on the islands, that the United States would make certain that it would not return Okinawa to Japan. Okinawa is an extremely important island for Japan. And the Americans made quite clear that if you cut this deal with the Soviets, we're not going to return Okinawa to you. And further, they knew that if the Japanese demanded all four islands back, that would torpedo the negotiations, and it successfully did so. So in 1971, the U.S. returned Okinawa to the Japanese. Now, as a result, there is still not a peace treaty between, well, of course, Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, but there's not a peace treaty between Russia and Japan. It's an unresolved situation. And it was deliberately over this effort by the United States to prevent a peaceful resolution of this dispute. And the same goes for these islands that the Chinese and the Japanese are fighting about. Originally, what happened is that in 1945 at the Potsdam Conference, the Allies said that they were going to not only dismantle the Japanese Empire, but they were going to remove from Japan everything that it had gained as a result of imperial adventure, which would have included the 1898 Sino-Chinese War, in which the Japanese seized these islands, even though the Chinese always claimed that they were theirs, and they have a much better case than the Japanese for. The United States deliberately did not settle that question in 1951, even though that was clearly part of the Japanese Empire. They deliberately didn't settle it. They left the sovereignty unsettled, so that it would be this source of tension eventually.
Well, and then would you say the same about just reunification on the Korean Peninsula too?
Sure, absolutely. And a reunification on the Korean Peninsula, and for that matter, Vietnam as well. You had a situation where division is what they wanted. And as long as there was division, then there was a place for the United States to meet its own strategic interests. Now, you know, this is something, of course, that we didn't invent. I mean, when you think about it and you take a look at what the British and the French did in the Middle East, I mean, they did the same kind of thing, you know.
But now we're talking about it's been a generation since the end of the Cold War, and we don't have that excuse anymore about...
No excuse at all.
Right.
Hold
it right there. I'm sorry, we got to take this break, but when we get back, we'll talk more with Con Hallinan about the East Asian powder keg, the incredible system of alliances and threats and disputes that threatens to blow up at any moment here. FPIF.org for Con Hallinan. And we'll be right back in just a sec. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Marcy Wheeler on NSA stuff and CIA stuff and stuff. Jason Ditz on Germany's proposal for peace in Ukraine in just a little while. Bill Clinton, now there's audio of Bill Clinton from September 10th, 2001, talking about woulda, coulda, shoulda got bin Laden. Yeah, you think so? What? That's coming up in the next segment. But right now we're talking with Con Hallinan from Foreign Policy in Focus, America's East Asia Policy, and all the different disputes. Whenever you hear islands, think minerals and natural gas and things like this under the sea, of course, and all these ancient disputes. Khan's been describing America's policy of keeping all these disputes going so that, you know, remember why they need us and all that kind of stuff. But now, when I said Korea, you said Vietnam, which I think maybe people might dismiss because, hey, that was back in the 60s and 70s. But I was thinking more recently when Bush, you can tell I don't know that much about the Korean issue. I got to go back this far. I'm sure there are better examples, Con. But I remember Bush giving a joint press conference with President Roh of South Korea. And he said, well, first we got to resolve the nuclear issue and then we can resolve, you know, a permanent peace between North and South Korea. And President Roh heard him wrong through the translator and said, wow, did you just say that we could work on reunification and peace at the same time as we're working on the nuclear issue, Mr. Bush? That's great. And Bush said, no, I did not say that. What I said was, we'll never work on peace and reunification. And right now we're using the nuclear issue that, of course, Bush himself created the crisis. And forced North Korea out of the treaty and all that anyway. But anyway, we're using this as the excuse to make sure that, no, you can never reunify, he said.
And the danger here is, you know, it's one thing to build, you know, formally build in this ambiguity, strategic ambiguity, although I really, my favorite term is manageable instability, which is an oxymoron if I ever heard of it. But it is also associated with something which most Americans are completely unaware of because it's never been part of any policy debate. And that is that we have a military posture in Asia, which is called air-sea battle, ASB. Mm-hmm. And it's been the official policy of U.S. military doctrine in Asia since 2010. And I think most Americans would be quite surprised because it calls for a war with China in the advent of any kind of tension that explodes. Not just simply war, calls for military defeat, and the term actually used in the document is World War II variety, you know, which is like...
Unconditional surrender.
Unconditional surrender.
Yeah.
And it calls for deep strikes into China aimed at command and control and satellite things and all that kind of thing. And remember now, China's a nuclear power, and it doesn't have a large number of nuclear weapons. It's not clear how many. Some people say a little over 100. Some people say as many as 200. probably on the higher figure. But it's not a large number of nuclear weapons. And there's a kind of an old rule in nuclear warfare, which is that if you have nukes and you don't use them, you lose them. That one of the first things an attack is going to do is to strike at your nuclear weapons in order to behead them, and then make it a conventional war. And of course, the United States is a lot more powerful militarily. The fact that they are even contemplating defeating China in a war, which would actually include a land invasion, is completely nuts.
A land invasion of China.
China. A land invasion of China. I mean, it's absolute madness. And what it is in reference to is that in the 1990s, the Chinese decided that their traditional way of thinking about the military, which is large land armies and large numbers of tanks and artillery and all this kind of stuff, was rapidly being outdated. And instead, what they wanted to do is they wanted to ensure the fact that the United States or any other group of people, allies, etc., could not invade China. And so they started this policy, which is called access denial. And what it is it's a mix of ballistic missiles, stealth submarines, surveillance, radar, satellite stuff, etc., cyber war as well, that would prevent any potential antagonist from essentially controlling the waters that surround China. And since 80% of China's energy supplies moves through the South China Sea and the East China Sea, this is kind of a life and death issue for them. And then in 1996, there was a growing tension between mainland China and Taiwan. And the Clinton administration put two aircraft carrier battle groups into the Taiwan Strait, which, by the way, is disputed land. Okay, that's another area of tension that was not resolved. There are little islands there, Quemoy and Matsu. Are those Chinese? Are those Taiwanese? And, you know, they're closer to China and whatever. The Chinese couldn't do anything about it. I mean, so these two big American battle groups showed up. And the Chinese were humiliated. They couldn't do anything about it. They decided at that point, that's not going to happen again. And they really put the pedal to the metal to develop this area access denial strategy. Mm-hmm. The air-sea battle is aimed at decapitating that access denial. And the thing that's important here is that the access denial doesn't call for an aggressive attack at Japan or the Philippines or any other U.S. allies in the region. What it's saying is that the Chinese intend to control their home waters. And this is this formal military posture now, with this tension growing, which just creates the possibility of a military clash. And the thing that's so crazy about it is there's never been any discussion. You know, Carl von Clausewitz, the great theoretician of modern war, said that war is politics by other means. Mm-hmm. The problem with air-sea battle is there are no politics involved in it at all.
Well, and now, so let me make sure I understand you right here, Con, because, I mean, it sounds like this is the Scheifen plan or some kind of thing where it's plan A is not, if it ever really comes to blows with China, here's how to try to resolve it as peacefully and as quickly as possible as plan A. It's full-scale, full-spectrum dominance, hydrogen bomb exchange warfare as plan A, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S.
Because, of course, the U.S. cannot destroy all their H-bombs on a first strike. They can't.
Right, and the idea that a nuclear country that is facing the possibility of military defeat, particularly China, you know, because they're a little sensitive about what's happened over the past 150 years, that is insane. I mean, there's a level, when I was reading this air sea battle, I just said, what are these people smoking?
Yeah.
You know, what are you talking about? It's completely crazy.
Yeah.
So you couple this, quote, managed instability with air sea battle. And, you know, right now, as bad as the situation is in Ukraine and how terrible the situation is in the Middle East, the thing that keeps me up at night is the East China Sea. And I think what it's done is, and it's also stimulated, I would have to say, the kind of wrong instincts on the part of the Chinese military, because one of the things the Chinese have done now is push into the South China Sea and made a series of very unreasonable demands for control of the Paracels, which they have a dispute with Vietnam disputes with the Philippines over the control of reefs and shoals, that the 1968 law of the sea really would give to the Philippines and would give to the Vietnamese. But the Chinese are using an old imperial map. Well, you can't use imperial maps, you know. Under that, the circumstances, the British still own India, right? That's not
well. But as the administration
still
would
own
say,
Ireland
it's
too,
and America has created the atmosphere here.
Absolutely, there's no question, and it's not only creating the atmosphere; it's deliberately encouraging the atmosphere, and it's worked because the tension, for instance, between Vietnam and China over the Paracels.
Right.
It's reached the point where there are a number of Vietnamese that are talking about bringing the Americans in to have a military alliance with the Americans because of the tensions between China and the Philippines over these shoals and reefs in the South China Sea. The Philippines has reopened a major military port and series of airfields for the United States. It has allowed the United States, this is part of the Asia pivot by the Obama administration, in which eventually 60% of America's military forces will be located in Asia. There are Marines in Australia. There haven't been Marines in Australia since World War II.
In other words,
now
you're saying there's
Marines
20 tripwires for war all
exactly.
over the place, entangling
Absolutely.
Alliances in knots over there.
And you also have a very aggressive, very right-wing, very conservative government in Japan, the Abe government, you know, who really kinds of thinks that World War II wasn't something they should feel bad about. In fact, it gave a recent statement, sounded an awful lot like the greater East Asia prosperity sphere that the Japanese pushed forward before World War II. And so you put all these things together, and I guess powder keg is, if anything, you know, to downplaying it. We're not talking about gunpowder here.
Yeah.
We're talking about nuclear weapons. And I think it also creates the tensions that eventually Japan would decide that it's going to build nuclear weapons on its own. And there are Americans who are pushing the Japanese in that direction. So the stakes here in Asia are enormous. It's extremely dangerous. And we're talking about at a time when the United States is economically still on the ropes from the 2007-2008 meltdown. You know, we're talking about a significant increase in military expenditures in Asia, all of which will, you know, move that hair trigger a lot closer to someone pulling it. It's a really dangerous situation. It's got me, as I say, it's got me up at night.
Yeah. It got my eyeballs glued to Foreign Policy and Focus, that's for sure.
Well, thanks very much
for your time, Con. I sure appreciate it.
Anytime, Scott.
All right, y'all, that's Con Hallinan. I went ahead and recorded him all the way through the break there because, I didn't want to stop him because he was saying good stuff. The whole thing will be up there available for you guys at scotthorton.org. The article is, again, Parsing the East Asian Powder Keg. And parse it, he does very well for you there at fpif.org. fpif.org. And I think maybe we're running it at antiwar.com today. I forget. Yes, we are. It's in the viewpoints right now at antiwar.com as well. All right. So anyway, yes, when it comes to radio production and these built-in hard breaks, sometimes I just, yeah, no. What can I say? I suck at it. But, you know, you try. You do what you can. As Bill Hicks might say, were he alive today. All right. Coming up, Jason Ditz on Ukraine and Marcy Wheeler on torture and spying and other CIA thingies. But right now, and I'm sorry, because I got, you know, there's a brand new Nick Turse out. We'll be running it tomorrow. It's all about AFRICOM and America's invasion of Africa. Another pivot going on there. Nick Turse, America's best journalist on the question of America's invasion of Africa. I might recommend his work to you. That's at tomdispatch.com. But right now, I got to find, here it is. It's Anna Mulreen at the Christian Science Monitor here. U.S. is no safer after 13 years of war, a top Pentagon official says. And who's the top Pentagon official? Oh, he's the outgoing director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. And I know what you're saying, defense intelligence, oxymoron, and all that. Funny joke. We might get a punchline out of the fact that it's 2014 now. Thanks a lot. You could have pointed out a long time ago all along, oh, now that you're retiring, you're going to tell us what a lousy job you've been doing, huh? And actually, I got one more little thing to say before I get into this thing. I remember right after the Iraq War when they never found the weapons and everybody was saying, democracy? What, you're going to give them a democracy? That's the war or whatever? The big talking point, the big U.S. Hasbara justification for the Iraq War was, but don't you feel safer? A new poll is out. Americans feel safer now that Saddam is gone. Blah, blah, blah. That was the narrative all through the summer of 2003. We can't show you any warehouses full of VX and sarin and mustard and other nerve gases and these things. No. But Americans feel safer. Right, yeah, that's because the government and the media had lied to them and told them that they were in danger. And then told them that the danger had been killed. So what? They felt safer. The exact same poll result could have just said, Americans are stupid. Will believe anything that lying murderers tell them because of how stupid they are. So they feel safer. Feel safer? How about, even to be fair about it, do you think that you are safer? How about that for a poll question? Do you think that you know that you are safer? Or tell me about your feelings. What the hell is that? I guess if you were polling sixth graders, that would make sense. Do you feel safer, kids? But for the grown-ups, how about, do you think that you know that you're safer or not? And then that question still is just a measure of how right or wrong they are, not what the truth is, because they say so. Saddam Hussein was keeping you safe from the jihadis who would have conquered all of North and Western Iraq. Don't you see? Saddam Hussein was keeping you safe. I don't care what your stupid emotions told you. Oh, I feel safer now. Yeah, well, your emotions are retarded and illegitimate, okay? You are in more danger now. You've been in more danger since March of 2003. And now the outgoing head of the DIA says so. All of my and the entire national government's efforts over the past 13 years against terrorism has been for naught, he declares. You know, assuming the lie that that's what they were really trying to do was protect you from terrorism. Because what they did was they knocked off 2.5 secular dictators so far and turned Iraq and, as you just heard, Libya into lawless jihadistan, as well as more than, well, I don't know, half of Syria. There was no Al-Qaeda on September 11th. They were Osama, Zawahiri, and their few dozen friends, a couple of hundred guys. That's all it was. Now it's a belief. Now, as he says, core Al-Qaeda is a belief. It is not a group of men. And it's been that way since George Bush declared his policy would be to prove Osama right about every single one of his accusations against the United States and his justifications for attacking us. And George Bush said, I'm going to make this guy seem right to people as best I can, apparently. Because then, after knocking off the government in Afghanistan and declaring he'd stay forever, he then went to number three or four on bin Laden's list, the quote-unquote secular socialist infidel, Saddam Hussein. That's what bin Laden called him. You know, Saddam, the guy with the clean-shaven chin. That guy. The guy in the olive-green fascist military uniform. Who was not an Islamist. Who was not allies with Osama bin Laden. Who had a death warrant for Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. They went and knocked him off and they turned the entire North and West, the entire Sunni Triangle as they call it, where it's majority Sunni Arab land in Iraq, they turned that into jihadistan the whole time. And then they fought a war for the other faction, the Shiite Arab militias backed by Iran, which just, of course, helped set us up for the conflict going on now, where Saudi Arabia and all their allies will stop at nothing to try to back the Sunni Islamists of the Sunni Triangle in order to limit the rise of the Shia that America accomplished for them. The king of Saudi Arabia told George Bush, and this is in the WikiLeaks, thank you, Chelsea Manning, doing 35 years in prison. This is in the State Department cables. The king of Saudi Arabia said to George Bush, I don't understand. Your father and Ronald Reagan's policy always was that it's you and me and Saddam against the Iranians. But now you are going to hand southern Iraq over to Iran on a golden platter, he said. A golden platter. That's like silver, only even more precious. And so I'm not saying it's in and of itself a bad thing that the Shia control Baghdad. What do I care other than they killed a million people in a civil war to make it that way? And other than now they've motivated every Sunni Arab government and for that matter religious leader in the entire region to try to do something about it. Because they'll be damned if the Shiites are going to control Baghdad from now on. If they have to fight about it from now on. But now the head of the DIA, the outgoing, now retiring head of the DIA, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, says, you know what? You're not safer. You're less safe after two wars and trillions of dollars spent, after more than a million people have been killed. And don't say you weren't warned. Even Colleen Rowley, who, if only they had let her do her job, could have stopped September 11th, her and her group of FBI agents out of Minneapolis. She warned in her letter to the Senate, if you do a war against Iraq, this is going to be the single greatest thing that happened to the terrorists ever, ever. This is going to make it look like they're right about us, that all we want is to take their oil and kill them, and et cetera, that they're the victims, that we're the aggressor. And it's going to only help them. And she's one of 1,000 people that gave that same warning. Walton Mearsheimer gave the same warning, too. A great many realists and libertarians and a lot of other people gave the same warning before the Iraq War. Well, here's the outgoing head of the DIA. Everyone at antiwar.com was right, and everyone who disagreed was wrong this whole time. Thanks for nothing, Dick. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. So along the same theme here, America, of course, has been backing the Mujahideen, one level or another in Syria, the last 3 years. against Iran's ally. This is the redirection. Oops, we empowered Iran. Now we're back on the side of the Saudis, listening to them and backing their allies. Not so much the Muslim Brotherhood, who the Saudis hate, but groups like ISIS and al-Nusra have been the prime beneficiaries of American money and weapons over there, no matter how deniable they try to make their support for these groups by funneling it through the FSA first or whatever. And now the Syrian war has blown back in Iraq. Landay was on the show, Jonathan Landay from McClatchy, talking about, yeah, it's true. As Maliki has been begging for weapons from the Americans to fight ISIS in Iraq. Remember, a year ago, we talked about how, in fact, that's in my article from a year ago that I wrote for the FFF, about how there had been some talk of the CIA flying drone missions working with the Iraqi government, that is the Shiite government of Baghdad, against ISIS. Well, eventually they ended up calling that off because the Americans were mad. Remember, Biden even, you know, publicly chastised the Iraqi Shiite government for allowing the Iranian Shiite government to send weapons and support to the Assad Shiite government in Syria to keep the Sunni-based insurgency down, al-Qaeda down. And they were so mad at Maliki for letting Iran help Assad in the fight that we are all allies in on against ISIS, etc. They wouldn't help Maliki fight them. And then they blew right back and ended up taking Mosul and declaring a caliphate. And, you know, I don't know if the Americans ever really meant for them to go that far, but I don't know. It's not very deniable when for years on end, everyone knows that there really are no moderates. Not really. I mean, there's an FSA, but it's always been a very small part of the insurgency there. It's the Nusra, sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri and the Islamic State, which broke off from them, but is basically still just al-Qaeda in Iraq. Zarqawi's group, formerly loyal to Zawahiri, but still the very same goals, if not, it's internal politics that separates them now, not what they're about in any sense, really. And so everybody's known all along, they're the ones getting the weapons and fighting the war. And now here, jihadist swarm, Syria army base, post photos of beheaded soldiers. And this is in the Raqqa province. Surprise, the Syrians had an army base that far east. In the central Homs region, government forces recaptured Al-Shar gas field, seized by ISIS a week before. Islamic State seems to always melt away rather than take on the Syrian army head on. They seem to leave that up to al-Nusra and other fighters, the Al-Sham Brigade and whatever the hell. Because why get killed? It's smart. They basically own the entire east of the country at this point anyway. But yeah, they're going around fighting against the Shia and fighting against the Syrian army. They sacked this one base, I guess. Mass executions of Shiites into Crete. Over there in Eastern Islamic State, I don't think it's really right to call them Syrian Iraq anymore. Over there in Eastern Islamic State, Crete is now firmly back in the hands of ISIS, it seems like. While the fighting continues to rage in Syria. And then check out this headline. And I know it's probably some propaganda. I don't even know if it's really true. But anyway, I'm paranoid as hell about this, man. Suicide bomber from U.S. came home before attack. The guy from Florida who went and did a suicide bombing in Syria, the American intelligence officials are now telling the New York Times that he came back to America after fighting with ISIS for a while and then went back and did a suicide attack over there. And it's just like I told him, I mean, there's been thousands of these guys. Remember, one of these kids was indicted for trying to go over there, and his father said, hey, he was recruited by the CIA. Department of Justice, let him go. That's not fair. You recruited him to go fight in the holy jihad. This is the good jihad in Syria, right? What the hell? Oh, he got prosecuted. But still, they've encouraged this war and discouraged any kind of peace talks this whole time since the war broke out in 2011. As Obama explained to Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic, it was only because he was trying to satisfy Israel and their hatred of Iran, and weakening Assad, it was a good way to weaken Iran's position in the region. Goldberg and Obama agreed. And so they've kept this thing going on, and at this point now, at least according to the pigs, thousands of Westerners, Americans, fewer Americans, many more Europeans, but Western Europeans with Western European passports and under Western European passport rules as far as getting into America, have gone to Syria to fight. And now it doesn't take somebody who's motivated enough to go to Syria to fight to have to go to Syria first in order to necessarily do anything horrible and violent. That's the scary part, right? If these guys can be recruited to go to Syria, they could be recruited to stay right here and do something horrible, or stay in France or in Spain or wherever they're from, or in England, do something horrible there. It's the case that look at Faisal Shahzad. They said, hey, man, don't join us. Don't join the Pakistani Taliban here in Pakistan and fight. Go back to America and try to blow up something in New York, they told him. And he did. He tried to blow up Times Square back in 2010. Anyway, this could happen. Look at the September 11th hijackers. They were Egyptian graduate students in Hamburg, Germany, who went through, you know, the normal rite of passage that so many young Arabs go through or went through back then to go to Afghanistan and go training through the camps and whatever. But then the Al-Qaeda leadership got word that, hey, these guys have German passports. They could be very useful. You ever wanted to be in the special forces, Mr. Mohammed Atta? He was asked, and so joined up. Him and Ramzi bin al-Shib and all that. So this really is a danger, I think, that some of these guys, I mean, we're so lucky that Faisal Shahzad's bomb did not work, that he didn't have the resources to put together something that, you know, could really do much damage, and the whole thing damn fizzled out. I don't know, if the fuse had gone off correctly, I don't know how bad it would have been, but pretty damn bad, considering that he's in the middle of Times Square, full of civilians everywhere. So, anyway, man, this is, and then you hear the Republicans talk about impeaching Obama, and yet none of it has to do with wink, wink, nudge, nudge support for ISIS in Syria the last 3 years. Why? Because the Republicans are worse traitors for Israel even than Obama. They've been attacking Obama for not intervening on the side of the Mujahideen more. And I know that they pretend, no, we want to back the moderates to marginalize the Mujahideen. But that's a damn lie. You want to marginalize the Mujahideen in Syria, you back Assad. Or at least you back nobody. You sure as hell don't pretend there's some third force of moderate fighters that are going to overthrow Assad and kick ISIS out of the country. Give me a break. Only liars claim to believe that. No one really believes that. But they've got their priorities. Just like Michael Oren, the last Israeli ambassador to the United States, explained the priority, his priority, as he put it. He tried to distance himself, but he couldn't help but lapse back into correctly characterizing his position as from Israel's point of view, meaning the Netanyahu government's point of view. They prefer the suicide bomber Bin Ladenite Islamic State, Sunni radicals, Islamists, versus the Syrian government and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And why? Because they are backed by Iran. And that is why America's policy has been to support the Mujahideen in Syria this whole time, because that's what Israel wants. And the right-wingers, the John McCain and the entire Republican Party, other than Rand Paul, actually, I'll give him somewhat credit, have been attacking Obama for not doing enough to back the rebels over there. And when John McCain went and met with the so-called moderates, it was the Northern Storm Brigade, which Time Magazine already had on video on the internet, saying, yeah, we're all veterans of the Iraq War. You know, here I have John McCain here somewhere saying, oh, we can vet the rebels, really? He was over there meeting with the worst of them. Where the hell is my clip? Anyway, and then the Al-Farouk Brigade, they were some guys who wanted elections rather than an Islamic State, and yet they're the cannibals.
Well, by identifying those people who are on our side, we can identify who these people are. We can help the right people.
Yeah, there you go. Like the Northern Storm Brigade, who learned how to fight killing Americans in Iraq. Right, John? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, guys, welcome back to Dang Thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. Ow, kind of bit the inside of my mouth. They're not good at talking. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Next up is our friend Jason Ditz, news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. Welcome, Jason. How are you?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good, except that, man, did you see this thing here? This wasn't really my plan, but we're going to talk about all kinds of different stuff for the interview today. So I'm going to go ahead and start this out here. Just breaking from Australian news media, NBC, Alex Seitz-Wall at NBC has the clip here. It's amazing. On September the 10th, 2001, Bill Clinton told a group of Australian media people at what exactly the event was where he was speaking. A group of businessmen, 30 businessmen. On September the 10th, 2001, and Bill Clinton talks about how he could have got Osama bin Laden. Let's listen.
And I'm just saying, you know, if I were Osama bin Laden, he's a very smart guy. I spent a lot of time thinking about him. And I nearly got him once. And I could have killed him, but I would have had to destroy a little town called Kandahar in Afghanistan and kill 300 innocent women and children. And then I would have been no better than him. And so I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that's interesting. And of course, it's, and Bill Clinton is legendary for this, of course. It's just a partial truth. According to Michael Scheuer, he and his CIA team gave Bill Clinton 10 different chances to kill Osama bin Laden. And according to one Senate reporter or another, at one point, Jason, they counted as many as 13 chances given by American intelligence to Bill Clinton, who, of course, Bill Clinton was the one who had Sudan kick Osama out and send him off to basically to safety in exile in Afghanistan back in 1996 in the first place. And so anyway, it's not that I'm necessarily in favor of him murdering kids, but I don't, and the CNN, the NBC article actually notes that intelligence officials absolutely dispute that 200 to 300 civilians would have died in that attack or these others too. Maybe there would have been some collateral damage, but certainly not that much. At least one of these was going to be an attack just on his farm where there were a few dozen people, perhaps including children. But then again, he's still starting from the premise he would have had to just, drop 1,000-pound bombs on him or something. It would have been impossible to send in, special forces to try to pick and choose targets more carefully and yet still get the guy, any of that. But it's just amazing. That's from September 10th, 2001. I don't know what to ask you about it, Jason. So what do you got to say about that, man?
I don't know. That's incredible to me. I mean, it's not surprising, I guess, but the timing certainly is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, it's just sounds like just coincidence, obviously, that was the date on it. But still, that's really something. And anyway, it's important, I guess, not just for like trivia's sake, but that, you know, he's acknowledging some responsibility there for if he's not acknowledging that's his fault for helping to generate the Al-Qaeda enemy against the United States. At least he's accepting responsibility for not doing anything about it there before Bush ever arrived in town.
Right.
All right, well, so let's get to current crises, and I guess we could just pick them out of a hat here. I don't know, but you've got this very important piece here at news.antiwar.com. Germany pushes broad plan to settle Russia-Ukraine dispute. Oh, my God. You're telling me there's an adult that runs a government somewhere in the Western Hemisphere, Jason? Is that right?
Yeah.
Breaking news.
I mean... There's an actual proposal here that.
All right. Well, break it down. It's a grand bargain. That sounds pretty good.
It really does. I mean, it's kind of reaching at a lot of different disputes at once because, of course, you know, from the U.S. perspective, Russia's just after land. From the Russian perspective, the big problem is the gas dispute. This tries to resolve everything.
Wow, so that's pretty good. And then, so what are the Americans saying about it so far? Anything?
Nothing so far. There hasn't been a single public comment that I can find from any U.S. official on it, although there's been some talk that the U.S. probably isn't in favor of this deal because it would ultimately have the international community recognize the Crimea's accession into the Russian Federation.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, we can't have that recognition of outright reality that's obviously and absolutely irreversible. But, okay. So was it June the 30th? Was that the last time the Germans tried to work something out and the Americans stopped them?
I'm not really sure about that. It seems like this has been on the table at least since then, but it's not clear that they ever really completely stopped trying to work this out.
Mm.
And
yeah, I guess I phrased it wrong. It was really the Americans told Kiev to ignore the Germans and continue on attacking the East is really what I meant to say there.
Right. And the people familiar with the situation say that this is basically the only game in town if you're going to be negotiating. No one else has put forward any plan at all, let alone a comprehensive one. The U.S. plan is basically for Russia to unconditionally surrender all their disputes, just give Ukraine whatever it wants.
But Jason, I mean, isn't it the case that only the most right-wing, ridiculous hawks in America... Well, I shouldn't call McCain right-wing. He's pretty centrist extremist. But anyway, isn't it just McCain and Bolton and how about the kookiest on the right who are for, you know, for example, bringing Ukraine into NATO at this point? I mean, the Europeans certainly don't want that. And I thought that most of even the consensus in D.C. had backed off from outright bringing them into NATO, at least in the near term, no?
Well, that's true. But as far as the status of the Crimean Peninsula, as far as resolving the situation with the rebels in eastern Ukraine, mm-hmm. the U.S. public position has been Russia has to withdraw unilaterally from the Crimea despite the referendum, and just let Ukraine re-annex it. They have to forcibly disarm the eastern rebels in Ukraine and let the Ukrainian military roll over them. I mean, their positions that on their face, common sense would tell you Russia isn't going to possibly accept.
Yeah.
So they're really just a pretext for more sanctions and more hostility.
Well, now, and of course, if the American position in D.C. is, okay, we don't really want to bring Ukraine into NATO at this point, that might be a bridge too far. That doesn't necessarily mean they're willing to promise that on paper to the Russians or anything. That's a whole other question.
Right.
So, and now, so as far as the proposal itself here, it's proposed to who exactly? Is it calling for talks between everybody involved or just... Here's a deal that could be brokered between Kiev and Donetsk, or what?
Well, it's a deal that involves Kiev, it involves Donetsk, it involves Russia, and...
What about the U.S.?
Well, it would have to involve all the permanent members of the Security Council as far as the recognition of Crimea as part of this offer.
Right.
But... I mean, as far as the war in the East, the settlement is basically the rebels agree to disarm in return for some significant concessions from Kiev, including increased autonomy for the two breakaway provinces. And right now, there's no indication the Ukrainian government would go for that, but as time moves on, they're going to be under increasing pressure to do this, especially from Germany, because one of the other key points of this deal is...
Now, hold it right there at the other key point, Jason. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, y'all. News.antiwar.com for Jason Ditz's work. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jason Ditz from antiwar.com, news editor there, news.antiwar.com. You got to bookmark that. You guys read news.antiwar.com every day, right? Yeah, of course you do. We're talking about Ukraine. Jason's helped keep track of what's going on there. And now, when we were interrupted by the break, Jason, you were saying that pressure really is mounting, I guess, from the West on Kiev, that they're going to have to put an end to this thing by way of negotiation, not by conquering the East. Is that right?
Right, because conquering the East doesn't really help anything. I mean, it resolves this particular dispute over this relatively worthless couple of provinces in the east. But the real problem between Ukraine and Russia from the European perspective is the natural gas dispute. It's been, well, about 2 months now since Ukraine has gotten any natural gas from Russia. They have a fairly substantial stockpile, and of course it's summer, so they're not using very much right now. But various estimates say they're going to run out sometime in the fall or winter, and those pipelines going from Russia into the Ukraine are also the same pipelines that go into Western Europe and to countries like Germany that are getting huge percentages of their energy that way. So the concern from the Europeans is once Ukraine runs out, they're inevitably going to start trying to siphon off gas, which means Russia's probably going to cut off the gas, which means they're going to be cutting off the gas to their European customers, too.
Right. So, in other words, the Americans can talk big all they want, but to the Europeans, hey, we got to make a deal here right now. Their very stability internally is at stake here. They got to keep the energy coming no matter what.
Right, and the U.S. has presented this as something that they can resolve with increased exports to Europe, but it's really ridiculous to think that the U.S., even if they did start wholesale exporting liquid natural gas, could export anywhere near the amount that all of Europe would need to replace what they get out of Russia, because Russia's Gazprom company is the largest natural gas company in the world by a factor of 10. I mean, they're enormous. There is no replacement out there.
Right. Yeah, well, there's some talk about, well, America's just got to ramp up our fracking so much that we can then, and I don't know how many years worth of new infrastructure building this would take, that we're going to take up the slack. We're going to export so much, eventually export so much natural gas to Europe. What kind of pipe dream is that?
Right, and there are some plans to build some liquefaction plants that would allow us to export natural gas. The prices in the U.S. are a lot cheaper than they are in Europe or Asia, so there's a lot of appeal for the energy companies to do that, but those sort of huge plants don't go up overnight. That's something that's going to take years, if not decades, to complete.
Well,
and in the meantime... expecting Europe to just sit out in the cold and wait is ridiculous. They're obviously not going to do that.
Right. All right, so now, can you tell us a little bit more about the war in the East and how many people have been killed and just how much it's been escalated recently? I know they've announced a whole new escalation, but that doesn't necessarily always seem to pan out in practice, but I don't know.
Well, it's really difficult to come up with accurate death tolls in the East because the Ukrainian military offers sometimes wild death tolls in what they're calling an anti-terrorist operation. There are times where they'll issue multiple statements a day claiming 500 rebels were killed here, 500 rebels were killed there, to the point where if all of these were true, the death toll would be in the tens of thousands by now, and there's no indication of that. I would say the death toll probably is in the low thousands, but it's impossible to come up with a reliable number. It's even more difficult than coming up with figures out of countries like Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, I guess so then the same answer for where any lines might happen to be or which cities are under what amount of control of either faction?
Well, Donetsk is still under rebel control, certainly, and so is Luhansk. And those are the two big cities here. Slavyansk, which was a rebel possession, fell to the military a couple of weeks ago. A lot of villages are sort of under siege at any given time by the military, but exactly where they stand, which ones have fallen, which ones haven't fallen, it really, really depends who you're listening to.
All right, well, again, to recap, the most important part of this is so far the Americans have nothing to say about this latest German push for peace.
Right, and the fact that the Ukrainian military has kept going on fighting probably suggests the U.S. hasn't been very supportive of the deal. Otherwise, the Ukrainian military probably would have been pushed into more open negotiations on the terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know how easy that should work with the Israelis anymore, but that sure as hell should work with Kiev if Obama says, all right, that's it, do what Merkel is proposing. They would go along with that in a heartbeat, right?
Right.
Or every reason to suspect so, anyway. All right. Well, man, I'm sorry I asked you about Ukraine so much. I didn't save time to ask you about the terror tunnels there, but I know you've got a really good write-up there at news.antiwar.com about it, Jason. At least, can you just tell us very briefly whether all those tunnels are really just for killing Israeli civilians with, or what?
Well, no, of course not. I mean, the tunnels almost exclusively go into Egypt, not to Israel. There are some that go into Israel, but it's a very small minority of the tunnels. And these tunnels have been being built for 5 to 10 years because of this blockade and have become basically the entire economy of the Gaza Strip. This is how all imports and exports are conducted, is through tunnels, because there are no border crossings that are reliably opened.
So this is not a whole new species of tunnels. These are all the same damn tunnels we've known about all along.
Right. They're just suddenly being rebranded as terror tunnels because there's a war going on.
Right. And do you have any kind of guess as to the numbers exactly of tunnels that actually did go into Israel?
It's probably in the dozens. I don't know that it's any higher than that. The number of tunnels overall is enormous, of course. But
Well, I guess I did see where some fighters, presumably Hamas fighters, went through a tunnel and attacked some Israelis, but they were not civilians in a kibbutz or something. They were Israeli border guards just on the outside of the fence there.
And naturally, you know, when there's a major war going on, naturally those tunnels are going to be used for that, but that wasn't why they were constructed.
Right. And it also, of course, it goes to show what the consequences are going to be if the siege stays but all the tunnels go, and how much worse off they'll all be. Again. All right. Well, thank you so much for all your great work. Jason Ditz, everybody. News.antiwar.com. We'll be right back.
Thanks, sir.
Appreciate it, man.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Our next guest is Marcy Wheeler. EmptyWheel.net. is the name of her blog. That's how you get there, too, you know. Her address bar, emptywheel.net. And she's got a couple other good writers that join in and write on her great blog as well. And you can follow her on Twitter at emptywheel as well. Welcome back to the show, Marcy. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing really good. Oh, I better turn up your volume a little bit here. Hey, so lots of important stuff going on your beat here, and that is national security, state news, and legalities, and these kinds of things, torture and spying and all of that. And so I guess first things first, let's talk about torture and the torture report. And I guess could you give us the status of the haggles and then, you know, over who's releasing what and when? And then what about these new talking points that were accidentally leaked, they're saying? I don't know.
Well, first, did you see the breaking news that John Brennan has confessed that CIA did illegally spy on the Senate?
Oh, yeah, that was in there, too.
Yeah. So yeah. That's
go
the
ahead.
Breaking news.
Go ahead and talk about that.
Now that DOJ has cleared the CIA, is not going to criminally investigate them, John Brennan came to Dianne Feinstein and Saxby Chambliss and admitted that, in fact, they had broken the law and spied on their congressional overseers. So that's the back. That's where we end up.
That is such a big deal, too. I mean, if there weren't, you know, six wars and the prospect of eight going on right now, that would just be the absolute, you know, constitutional crisis of the decade right there. Imagine the CIA spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee. What?
Right. And spying to figure out what they were doing with the torture report, which is due, which is probably got dumped back in Dianne Feinstein's lap at the same moment as this IG report showing that she had been spied on. So it's a crazy week for her. The Senate intelligence, the torture report, barring gross redactions that the Senate will fight, we should expect the Senate torture report to come out in the next couple weeks. One of the things the Senate torture report reveals is that Colin Powell was not briefed on the torture that we actually knew, or at least I knew because I reported back in 2009. But, you know, the AP is catching up on that front. But what's interesting is that some of the ambassadors in the countries where we were torturing people, so places like Thailand, Poland, Romania, Egypt, some of those ambassadors did know about the torture, and they were instructed not to tell their bosses about it.
That's amazing. And you think that that really held, huh? That many ambassadors refused to tell Colin Powell what they knew about torture going on under their jurisdiction?
Well, not all of them knew. And then, I mean, I looked at just two examples. One is the ambassador in Thailand, while we were torturing Abu Zubaydah, literally got his ambassador papers. I mean, he presented his credentials, which is the formal part of presenting yourself to the host country. He presented his credentials the day after Abu Zubaydah was captured. So he comes in and all of a sudden he has to deal with torture on his watch. So, you know, I don't know if they told him or not. What a way to start the job, though, right? Is your country's using the country that you are the ambassador to torture. One of the other interesting ambassadors, and again, we don't know whether these people were briefed or not, but Chris Hill, who was the ambassador to Poland, a career diplomat, ambassador to Poland from 2000 to 2004. So during the time when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was being waterboarded there and Abu Zubaydah was there and Abdal Rashim al-Nashiri and several other people were all there in Poland. And what's interesting about that is Chris Hill went on to have a really poor relationship with Dick Cheney. He subsequently got moved to South Korea, and was really involved in the six-party talks with North Korea. And Dick Cheney did not like him. And then he subsequently went on to be ambassador to Iraq. And, you know, I'm sort of intrigued that Dick Cheney, I mean, he took him on, probably spied on him, really did not like Chris Hill. And I'm really curious whether Hill got briefed about the torture going on in Poland. So interesting questions there. And the other interesting part of that is that basically AP got this story because the White House accidentally, they say, sent the State Department's talking points about the torture report to an AP journalist, which is interesting because the talking points are kind of crazy themselves. You know, it's the State Department trying to put a good spin on the Senate kind of confirming that we tortured and we were out of control and CIA was lying to its overseers. Hey, there's a theme to this discussion, isn't there? And, you know, they basically, their argument is it worked. Like, our democratic system worked because nobody was held responsible for torture. And now, 12 years after it started, it's finally becoming public.
Right. Yeah. Our system worked so well, we quit torturing even without accountability of any kind. See?
Right. Yeah.
It's great.
And ask some of the detainees at Gitmo whether that's actually true. But,
right, yeah, in Bagram and in Somalia.
Right. So the State Department wants this to be a democracy success story, which I'm a little bit skeptical about. But whatever, they've got to say what they've got to say.
Yeah, it really is incredible there. So now, and the best we're ever going to get here, unless somebody uploads it to WikiLeaks or something like that, is just the summary of the report. And at that point, the summary is redacted by the Senate, the CIA, and the White House. Anybody else?
Senate, CIA, White House. I'm betting that Poland and the UK got a shot at the content that pertains to them because they're pretty squeamish about this report.
Yeah.
So, right, you know, other countries. But,
and now, I'm sorry, to go back a second to the Colin Powell question there. You linked to this article. I'm sorry, I actually only hovered over the link, but I'm pretty sure it was that ABC article about they choreographed the torture of Khatani down there at Guantanamo Bay and the whole cabinet was there, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, so there were a bunch of stories in 2009 that tried to place Colin Powell at the scene of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, that's one of the reasons why I was pretty sure that we knew Colin Powell hadn't been briefed. There's a narrative that came from the Senate Intelligence Committee back in 2009 that actually was the initial beginnings of this torture report. It was done under Jay Rockefeller. And that showed that Colin Powell was not fully briefed on all the torture techniques until September 16th, 2003. So you're talking a year and a half after even CIA, I think, now admits they started torturing after a year and a half after we got Abu Zubaydah. They were already torturing with Egypt doing the torture for us. But so basically what happened is the State Department in January of 2002 balked and said, you know, you have to abide by the Geneva Conventions. And the Bush administration's response to that, and I think I strongly suspect that the torture report is going to confirm this, the Bush administration's response to that was just to make sure that nobody at state learned about the extent and the techniques that we were doing, the kinds of tortures that we were doing. So, you know, they had to bypass Colin Powell and the rest of the State Department to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. Have you talked with Lawrence Wilkerson about this at all?
I haven't. Not no.
Huh. Well, maybe I should get him on the show.
I've talked to him about torture. Yeah, you should actually.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've spoken with him about this, but I know, you know, he told me years ago. It got headlines more recently, but he told me years ago he'd be happy to go in front of a grand jury and testify against Dick Cheney for this torture stuff, and he knew all about it. And I'm trying to remember now his narrative about when he first became hip to these truths.
Well, and remember that there are
quick.
Really good allegations that we tortured to get evidence for Iraq.
And oh, yeah. Well, that's where we're going to pick up this conversation on the other side of this commercial break. Thank you, Marcy, for saying so. A very important point. Marcy Wheeler, the great Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel online, emptywheel.net. and at Empty Wheel on Twitter. Give us just a sec here, y'all.
Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
All right. Surreal. On CNN right now, they're interviewing an American who's going to join up the service. The Israeli Defense Forces, that is. All right, good times. Is that legal? Oh, there's no law. Okay, good deal. Amazing. Now, speaking of there not being a law, it was rumored before, although I guess it was just PR, that torture was against the law in America and that the law in America applied to government officials, too. And now, of course, we have the ultimate example of that just not being the case at all with the torture regime we're talking about here. And right as we're interrupted by the break there, Marcy, we're just beginning to get into the primary question on the lips of every CIA torturer, and that was, tell me about Saddam.
Well, tell me about the relationship between Al-Qaeda and Saddam and how, and while I am making you think you're drowning, tell me that Al-Qaeda provided chemical weapons to Saddam. So more specifically, it wasn't just to tell me about Saddam. It was invent a relationship between Al-Qaeda and Saddam so that we can attack Saddam under the guise of counterterrorism.
Right. Yeah. And then as my friend is pointing out in the chat room here, of course, the whole scam was we need somebody making these accusations on tape, and then they're just going to destroy the tapes anyway. They could have just made it up without even torturing anybody. They didn't need to torture Al-Libi or anybody else into this stuff.
Well, you know, they – never mind. I was going to get into how Al-Libi sort of got suicided at the time in 2009 when the Senate Intelligence Committee was just investigating this. But maybe we should talk about NSA and the reform that's not really all that great.
Yeah. Well, on the, one more note on that is that, and I'm sure that you have the encyclopedia of it somewhere on emptywheel.net, but I could also recommend Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers, who did a great report on the connection between the torture regime and the lies, as you say, connecting Saddam Hussein's apparatus with that of Osama bin Laden. So that's not just some conjecture. There's, you know, a lot of solid reporting about that if people want to look into it. Anyway.
Yeah, Landay did a great work on that.
Yep. All right. As he did a lot of that stuff. All right. So, yeah. Yes, please talk to me about the new Leahy bill, Patrick Leahy in the U.S. Senate, the USA Freedom Act. Is that what it's still called?
We're still calling. I haven't thought of the nickname for it yet, but once I do, I'll let you know. The original one, USA Freedom, became USA Freedom because it got watered down. Then it became USA Freedumber because it got watered down still further. This one's probably around the same level as USA Freedom. It has maybe a few more transparency pluses and then some other things that concern me. But, you know, so Leahy is trying to do, to his credit, I think he genuinely wants to do something to improve the dragnet surveillance and got together with the administration, probably with Bob Litt again. And Bob Litt is, you know, he's a jerk, but he manages to kind of own all the people in Congress that he tries to negotiate with. So congratulations to Bob Litt for being good at his job. Bob Litt is the general counsel for James Clapper. And, you know, they put together a bill that is better than the USA Freedumber Act, but still, just as an example, remember how witness after witness after witness after witness got got before Congress and said, well, we get the phone calls from bad, evil suspect and all the people he calls. And then we also get the people, all those people call. Mm-hmm. And the entire premise of this program, according to every witness who has testified, is it's about finding who bad people call and who those people call, right? It's about calls, phone calls actually made. Well, the bill that Leahy and a bunch of national, a bunch of non-governmental organizations, things like people like the ACLU and EFF, they're embracing, doesn't chain on actual calls made. It chains on connections. And I don't know what that means. I know as much about this phone dragnet as anybody outside of government, and I can't tell you what that means, and neither can any of these people who are running up and down and applauding this bill. Hmm. And so for all we know, it's what it's going to do is basically put the NSA inside your smartphone at the inside the offices of an immunized telecom. There's no language to prevent that. There's, you know, the only restrictions on what the NSA does once it gets into the offices of these immunized telecoms is that they have to have some kind of call record at each stage of the chaining process. But, you know, a phone number is a call record. A cell phone handset ID is a call record. So it's not clear what this bill does, and yet everyone's running around trying to get it passed already.
And including, you're saying, all the activists. And it's not that you haven't read the ACLU's blog where they explain their support. What are they saying about it? They just don't get it either, but they're not seeing what they don't get the way you do? Is that it?
Well, there's this kind of weird trauma in the surveillance, the anti-surveillance community, wherein every time we get to a deadline, you know, so the 2012 deadline for Vice Amendments Act, the 2011 deadline for USA Freedom, 2010 USA Freedom, 2009 USA Freedom, every time we get to one of these deadlines, the administration runs around screaming and then we don't make any improvements. And so I think their strategy is to trade away the farm ahead of time now rather than at the last minute. Because what this bill also does is extend the deadline for USA Freedom. It would be June of next year. So, you know, if this bill doesn't pass, the government's going to have to do something just to preempt this last minute capitulation and capitulate ahead of time. I mean, that's, you know, I don't know. It doesn't, this bill is not going to pass until after recess. So we've got a couple weeks to figure out what the heck the bill does. Mm-hmm. And the activist community, not all of them, but many of them came out ahead of time and said, yay, bill, you know, we support this bill, without finding out very basic things like what does connection chaining mean? That just mystifies me, but, you know, I'm not a membership organization. I'm just me. If anybody wants to donate to me, that's great. But otherwise, I just do what I do in my room every day and call it like I see it. And I see that this bill is an improvement off of USA Freedom Act. It doesn't entirely end bulk collection. In fact, I believe that it sort of, you know, for one kind of Section 215 stuff, it requires you to use an individual. For the other kind, the kind of traditional kind, it requires you to use a person. And the only reason to make that distinction is if you mean person in the broad sense, including corporate people. So in other words, they think that you can that it is not bulky to collect data on a corporation like Western Union, which there have been multiple reports CIA has done under Section 215. So in other words, they're collecting Western Union and sorting through it to try and find terrorist finance that way.
Yeah, I mean, if I understand you right, Marcia, what you're telling me is they're simply shifting, maybe a little bit about, you know, which database they're looking at, and they're shifting the terms used. But, we're looking at the connection, not the spreadsheet or whatever. But meanwhile, all they mean is which numbers they're calling which numbers, just like before. They need the haystack to find the needle and all that crap.
No, I think it's actually radically different.
An idiot. Pardon me.
No, it's all right. What this bill does clearly is it defuses the safely kept nuclear bomb of the government having all phone records of all Americans. And that's important. I don't want to minimize that. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the U.S. government will no longer have all our phone records for the past 5 years. So though it'll take them 5 years to age it off. So they'll have all our phone records from the last 4 years and then 3 years and then 2 years and so on. In exchange for that, they have to go to the court and say, this is a bad guy. We want to go chain on this guy's calls. In exchange for that, I believe what they are getting, because they have gotten immunity for the telecoms. They have gotten compensation for the telecoms. They can dictate what kind of resources they need at the telecom. I strongly suspect, and nobody knows the answer to this who can speak about it, but I strongly suspect that in exchange for that, they are going inside people's smartphones at the telecom. So that's fine if you don't know anybody who is a terrorist suspect or who could be deemed a terrorist suspect. But if you do, then I think this bill significantly raises the chance that the NSA is going to be able to collect domestically things like your geolocation and things like your address books and things like, you know, your calendars. And that's what has me so concerned about this.
Right. Well, yeah. And the location data seems like it's the all important thing, because well, just as much as I guess the cell phone data, I mean the number calling data, but it's what we're talking about here really is the automation of governmental conspiracy theories about people, right?
Well, this
that's
stuff
what we're
shouldn't
doing
be
is
legal.
Whose living room have you been in, and then what might that mean, right? And their interpretation is always going to be the worst about any association.
Right. And again, I want to stress, we don't know that, but we also don't know what they do. And there's nothing in the bill that prohibits that. So that's why I'm concerned.
I see. All right. Well, thank you for correcting my errors. I do my best. That's why I keep bringing you on, is because you know this stuff so well. And I sure appreciate all your work.
Thank you. Great to be on, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's the great Marcy Wheeler. Emptywheel.net is her website. And also, of course, her Twitter handle, Emptywheel. Thanks very much for listening. See you next week. I mean, tomorrow.